There's a universe out there, or perhaps in there. It's known to many, but to a great many more, it's only a word, not even very well defined. It's called cyberspace. You go there on your keyboard and with your mouse, and like Alice tumbling through the rabbit hole, you tumble through your screen. Inside, there's just about everything you can imagine, and some things probably beyond your imagining. Soup to nuts, scholarship to sex. It's literally a virtual cornucopia. On this edition of Conversations, we meet Robin Williams, whose books have taught novices and old hands to love their Macs and understand them. In the next hour, cyberspace, a frontier that's right around the corner, and we'll take a look at Macs and PCs, too. But first, a virtual world. Robin, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can you give us an introduction to cyberspace? I have to admit that I'm a non-cyberspacean, and my way of looking at it is that it has to be like Alice's Restaurant. Arlo Guthrie's You Can Get Anything You Want in Alice's Restaurant.
That's true. That's a great term for it. Mm. Yeah. Well, it comes from, oh, I wish I knew, I don't remember the name of the book. Some science fiction writer termed it, and I should know who it was, cyberspace, and it just has come to mean that place where we don't actually see and touch, but we can go out and get information, personal communication, meet people. Basically anything we do, otherwise, we can't get your groceries, but... And I think even though none of us could... It's difficult to define. Everybody kind of has a clue what it is. It's just through your computer out into the space that connects us.
There's out there the potential for intellectual interaction. That's the scholarship end. There's social interaction, just friends. You've been talking in Fairbanks about relationships, intimate relationships.
Yeah.
Out there. And there are, as I mentioned earlier, there's sex out there. Lots. In a virtual way. Non-touching but very sexual. What's this end of that world about?
Well, I think it's fascinating how humans have always taken communication and managed to bring it to an intimate level. And really what people are doing on the computer and meeting through the computer and having sex through their computers is nothing more than people have always done with letters, with telephone sex, with CB radios. It's just a new medium for that. But there's a difference. It because of its immediacy, because it's writing, I think, is a big part of it. That physical act of writing is a different kind of thing than just talking to someone on the phone. And so it takes it to a slightly different level and opens up different cans of worms.
Do you know what that means to you? I notice you use the word, it's different, but what is that, when you add writing to this intimacy, this interaction, what's that doing?
Well, if people who have kept journals understand what happens when you write, that I wasn't quite aware of because I never had time to write a journal, but when I started communicating online and writing letters to friends, I discovered that that process of writing brings things up deeper from you. It brings things up out of your heart and soul and creates a different kind of intimacy, I think a deeper intimacy than if you chat with someone on the phone. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking right now about the one-night stands online where you meet somebody and run off and have sex with them on the computer. I'm talking about right now.
There will be people listening who will think, what are they talking about? This is absolutely strange.
Well, I can explain a little more.
We'll get there from here.
Yeah. Yeah. But in the process of meeting people and talking with them and developing an ongoing relationship, when you write, you often work things out through yourself. I found that when I was writing letters to someone, I would talk about things that I know we wouldn't have talked about. And I can phrase them more eloquently. I can go back and edit it and look at my work. And because I'm uninterrupted, these thoughts go a little deeper. I explain them much more fully. I remember talking to someone on the phone and saying, talking about how I'd taken my family on this Caribbean cruise. And we just passed it over. If I'd been writing to him, I would have talked about how it felt to be with my entire family there, the kinds of things we did, the emotional changes we went through by being stuck on this boat. But because we weren't writing, it just got glossed over. And that was a clear indication to me of how we write differently, and the letters that I would learn from myself about. As I would talk about these emotions I was dealing with without being interrupted, with writing about them, I learned so much about what I was needing. So in this process that makes the computer relationship different, I think comes from that, that we get to a deeper level of intimacy than we would if we were just talking. And I firmly believe that's absolutely true.
What's the play of the screen and the keyboard in this? Is it different than if I were to write my letter, put it in an envelope, and mail it?
Well, for me, it's different because for me to get something on paper, you know, I do it on my computer, and then when it comes off the printer, I have to check all the line breaks and kern everything, and you know, I have to deal with so much more, and then I have to find an envelope that matches, and then I have to find their address, and I have to get a stamp, and then take it up to the mailbox, and it's just so much trouble that I don't do it very often. So on the computer, though, when email comes to me, it's so immediate, direct. I'm not so worried about typos. It's in some weird typeface, so I don't care where the line breaks are. That's going to change anyway. So it's much more immediate. It's much easier for me to actually communicate that way than going through the process of writing a letter. I'm not very good at that.
Do you think it not being in what we call hard copy, but in still in the ether, is closer to the emotions, or is that a jump that's not real?
No, because when I get letters from my friends, I print them up.
Oh,
I save
them.
You
do that. Mm-hmm. I see.
And even if it's on my screen, I still can read it over and over again. I can call it back up. I can ponder over parts of it, which I can't do on a telephone call, which I can't do in person. So even if I don't print it up, and I'm a very visual person, you know, I have to see things in writing. Anyway, it makes more sense to me. So for me, especially for people who are visual and who like written communication, it's more powerful to me. You know, some people are audio, and they might have a different kind of take on it.
Which may be yet another stage of computer reality at some point. This is Robin Williams today with us on Conversations. You know Robin Williams' name if you use a Macintosh computer. Her books, as I've mentioned earlier, have guided both novices and old hands to greater understanding and greater comfort with their Macintosh. Probably the two best known are The Little MacBook, and that's the introductory book, right? Just got a Macintosh, that's the book to get with it.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
And the second best known is The Mac is Not a Typewriter. Robin Williams moved on through from Macs to PageMaker, and is now in her thinking about her writing, getting ready to write about the intimate world that computers have let us see through the modem. If you have a modem, if you've taken a few trips into cyberspace, you may be perfectly comfortable with this conversation. If not, stick around. There'll be something to learn. This is Conversations on KUAC. You embarked on a relationship through your computer that began, from what I understand, you thinking about questions of intimacy and computers, relationships, and machines. How'd this relationship get started? You were doing what?
I was working on my PageMaker book, and I had just gotten my modem, and I was using America Online, and I was just learning about email, and I got a letter one day in my mailbox from some person. I assumed he did a search for people who are interested in Shakespeare. And so in my online bio, he pulled up Shakespeare. I think there were six of us online who were interested in Shakespeare. So he wrote me this letter that, he quoted Macbeth, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps on at this petty pace day by day. And he was really, sad and gloomy in this dark night in Georgia. So I don't know who this guy was, but I wrote him back and said, oh, lighten up. Macbeth's dysfunctional. And I sent him some lighter quotes, and so we just kind of wrote back and forth. He was a 24-year-old man in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was a 37-year-old single mother of three kids. So it was not a romantic thing at all. I mean, there was no question. I'm really not interested in young men. And he was not interested in 37-year-old divorced mothers of three. So that was never a thought of ours. But we really enjoyed each other's company, and he was a brilliant writer. So we just wrote letters back and forth. One night we accidentally met online at the same time. He was at a computer in Georgia. I was at my computer in Northern California. And we happened to be on the computer at the same time, and so we chatted. And it's kind of a long story, but we ended up developing... the relationship grew to a point where we liked each other so much that it became romantic, mm-hmm. and that almost seems to be an inevitability. It's very difficult to keep that from happening. I think that's due to that whole process of writing with the separation. There are certain things we don't get to. And I think it's a delusion, too, in many people. It deludes you into thinking that your relationship is closer and more intimate. So close and so intimate that other things can be ignored. You know, oh, I don't care what she looks like. I'm in love with her heart and soul. And that's just not true. I mean, we can't ignore the other half of our reality. Someone made a comment to me once that I thought was very interesting. She said that she's noticed that men are more often likely to get to an intimate relationship, not necessarily sexually, but just that deeper relationship online than they are in person. And her thought was that perhaps because of this, the way that writing, that whole process, it gets deeper into us, that it surprises men. That, you know, women are accustomed to talking with each other and relating to each other on a little deeper level. And oftentimes in person, it's hard to, you know, women are always complaining about not getting to that level with men. Mm-hmm. But online, through this written communication, men are getting there and being surprised by it, thinking, oh, this is it. This is the deep, intimate relationship I thought I wasn't capable of. Which I think was a very interesting perception. I'm not saying that's true or not, but I'm going to start looking at that a little more closely. Mm-hmm. But they're surprised by this intimacy that women can create between themselves and are always looking for. So they, I think she's right that it's men are getting to different levels of relationships more easily through that medium.
I wonder about those levels and whether this is a gendered concept or not, but about getting to deeper levels, if it doesn't also have to do with the fact that you do it alone, mm-hmm. when you're sitting in your room, wherever your computer is, and working, unless there's someone online with you, you are by yourself.
Yeah.
Looking at your thoughts or looking at your feelings on the screen.
Uh-huh. I think that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because there were conversations or letters that we would write back and forth with this particular friend, with any the people I write with online, but particularly with men, that I know we wouldn't have had at a coffee table. Mm-hmm. I know we wouldn't have. Because we interrupt, we digress, we read body language, we see their board, so we, you know... Mm-hmm. And this way, you got a platform, you can move forward, you can say it all, and you don't get that digression. So you're right, being alone is a big factor in it.
So here's my question, is it necessarily honest?
Well, that's a big question, and it's bigger than just in this sense, too, mm-hmm. because there's this... you know, there's the virtual versus the reality. There's the fantasy. How far does the fantasy go? How far do you delude someone in this fantasy? And it's certainly, on one level, it's certainly easy to pretend you're somebody you're not. You can pretend you're, you know, 5'3", 102 pounds, blonde, blue-eyed. But some things you can't pretend. I mean, you cannot pretend to be sensitive. You cannot pretend to be witty. You cannot pretend to have read a book to the point where you can discuss it. And so I think in the long run, if you get past a superficial one-night stand, I think it's much more difficult to pretend you're somebody you're not. There's certain things you can't. I mean, 14-year-olds come online and try to pretend they're adults. Well, I'm sorry. Yeah. there are things that give them away. There are things that give away the men who are pretending to be women. I think our truer self comes out even more with more strength over a period of time. Certainly for an evening, you could pretend to be anybody.
That's interesting. It makes it a lot more complex, doesn't it?
It does.
Because you do reveal yourself.
It does, and then it brings up this whole thing of what is the fantasy and what is the reality, and where does that fuzzy line end? You know, if a man is chatting with who he thinks is a woman and trying to come on to her and have sex with her, and she turns out to be a man who's pretending to be a woman, does it matter? Mm-hmm. I mean, who cares? You're just online. You're not seeing this person. What difference does it make? But it does. That straight guy really doesn't want to be having sex with a man who's pretending to be a woman. Even though on the one hand, oh, it's just pretend, I'm just typing on my keyboard, there's a big gray line. How far will I let this fantasy become fantasy, and how much do I want it to be real? So, yeah, big questions and big, how do we deal with this, and how far do we take honesty and truth, and mm-hmm. how much can I expect from this?
And it's the same. If we move from sex into that other area of intimacy or farther down that spectrum to the area of friendship, it's all the same discussion, is it not, that we can't...
Yeah. Well, I think the relationships that start out clearly as friendship with no motivations behind it are probably the most honest mm-hmm. and the most easiest to see who somebody really is. It's the ones that start out, you know, if you're starting out being deceitful, you know, it's going to show up somewhere. Mm-hmm.
What's virtual reality? There are people who probably won't get that phrase.
Virtual reality is kind of an oxymoron. It's pretend reality. You know, you're just pretending that this, it's something that's not really real, but it feels so real that you think it is virtual. Virtual, you know, meaning that not quite there, I'm just almost there. But that's another gray area. You know, I'm having a virtual relationship, a pretend relationship with some guy. If he breaks my heart and I'm in pain, and my pain is very, very real, then what's the virtual relationship? Mm-hmm. How much of this was just virtual and how much of it was really in my heart? And if it hurts, it's not virtual. And the relationships that people develop online, and not just one-on-one relationships, but a whole community. You know, there are writers clubs and dog clubs and World War II vet clubs and places where people go for support. And that support is so strong, and it is real. There's nothing virtual about that support. When you go online with a problem and six people say, oh gosh, you know, let me help you out, or you know, there have been fundraisers for people who had children with leukemia, and that community, there's nothing virtual about it. Just because you don't see them does not make that emotional support and sometimes that tangible support any less real or less valuable than if it was your neighbors down the street. In fact, it's stronger because you're choosing to be with people who have like interests rather than your neighbors who you just happen to buy a house next to, and you might have nothing in common with them. You're choosing to form a group of people that you have a bond with. So that virtual community is oftentimes even more valid than sometimes the community you live in. So calling it virtual is really kind of, it's a cyber community, a cyberspace community, I suppose, but it's real and true and honest and mm-hmm. big support.
Do you think that there is a heightened, that there are, there? Try this again. Do you think that there are heightened levels of honesty and dishonesty in cyberspace, or is it the same in a room full of Vietnam vets or lovers of Alsatian puppies, or where people gather physically.
Oh, you mean in the virtual communities?
Sure.
I'd say in the virtual community it's probably about the same, and it's amazing to me how you can walk into a room full of people on the computer, and when you're in a room together on most services, you can type like two lines. When you're actually online, writing letters back and forth, you can write pages and pages. But when you're online in real time, where you're both sitting at a computer, or 23 people are sitting at their computers around the country, you can typically type like two lines at a time, and that goes up on the screen. And it is amazing to me how you can tell who the cheerleader is. Oh, hi! And you can tell the cynic who's like leaning up against the wall with a smirk on his face. You can tell, you know, young Mr. Stud. People's personalities come through amazingly clearly in those couple of lines. So in a virtual community of the Alsatian Dog Club, those personalities come through whether you try to or not. And I think especially in two-liners, you can only pretend so far. Mm-hmm. And so I think in that kind of club or group, it'd be probably about the same. You can't help but be who you are.
So does life really exist in our minds? I mean, if we can tell all the same things, whether we're on a computer screen or in the room, physical room.
I wouldn't say that it means that the life is in our minds, because we can't neglect or ignore that other whole part of our reality. But I wouldn't, some people fear that, oh gosh, people will get so involved in their computers they'll never go out in public, they won't have friends, and I don't think that's a big concern at all. Some people abuse it, of course, but people abuse all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But I think the general masses of people, not many people are going to say, oh, I don't want to go dancing tonight, I don't want to have dinner with my mom, I want to talk to someone on my computer. It's just that most of us are sitting at our computers so much, and if we spend an hour or two a day there communicating with people, so what? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would much rather see people at their computer communicating for an hour or two a day than at their television set. At least you're in human contact. And I think, too, that we're human beings, and although some people might become hermits and live on their computer, most of us want human contact. You know, you might have virtual sex 6-7 nights a week, you know, or a couple of years. That doesn't mean if you have an opportunity to have sex with someone you really like in person, you're not going to say, oh, no, thanks, I'll take my keyboard. That's not a problem, I don't think.
Robin Williams is with us on Conversations. A quick look at her books: Beyond the Mac is Not a Typewriter, PageMaker 4, an easy desk reference for both Mac and Windows, Tabs and Indents on the Macintosh, Jargon, an informal guide to computer terminology. All these are out by Peach Pit over the last 4 years, Peach Pit Press. Jargon is a book that, being a PC user, I found myself very comfortable with. Everything I looked up, I understood. I loved it. Jargon, an informal guide to computer terminology. A couple of others: How to Boss Your Fonts Around, and the Non-Designer's Design Book. There is also a PageMaker 5, an easy desk reference, just out in 1994. Robin's beginning was as a design and typography person. She spent 14 years at Santa Rosa Junior College in Santa Rosa, California, teaching traditional and then electronic design and typography. Her path into computers came out of that art form. This is Conversations. Today we're talking with Robin Williams. So how did that electronic relationship turn out? Is that a question we can ask for you?
Oh, yeah. And that's what I talk about at the when I talk about this particular topic. I talk about this whole concept through this story and what I learned there. And when it started turning romantic, it quickly grew very intense, to the point where I, you know, didn't want to date anybody, didn't want to kiss anybody, because I was in love with this guy who I'd never met. So several times I said, in particular, this is misdirected energy. I'm 37 years old. I'm single. I don't want to direct my energy to this relationship on my computer, especially since you're a 24-year-old. So three times we tried to say, okay, we won't communicate anymore. And each time, you know, a week or two would go by, and I would think, well, I can deal with it now, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was painful. But we finally realized that it wasn't... We needed some kind of closure on it. We needed to actually physically meet in person, because so that that reality that he was 24 and I was 37, and not that that age difference is the thing, it's all that goes around that, you know what. We needed to physically meet in person in order to be able to get to a point where we could say goodbye. So we did. I flew to Atlanta, spent 3 days with him. And it was wonderful. We had a wonderful, wonderful time, you know, reading Shakespeare in the park. And he wrote me love songs and sang them on his guitar. And we climbed mountains and danced. And it was wonderful. But it also became very clear to me he really was a young 24. Mm-hmm. And it was very clear to him I really was a 37-year-old mother of three kids. And we had a very emotional separation, but we both knew it was enough... it was enough actual hard physical reality that we could then say, okay, this really isn't what either of us wants. And we separated. It was 3 years ago. I haven't spoken to him since.
Huh. And you haven't written, you haven't made connections through the computer?
No.
Is it because it was really, as you said, not a path that would bear fruit?
Right. And it was such a path, it was such an emotional, strong path that it wasn't a path that we could... stay friends. I mean, eventually I hope to see him again and be friends. But it was so strong that it had to be kind of either, look, we do this or we don't do it. It was very, because that's what we tried before I went to see him. We tried to be just friends and we couldn't take it back to that level. Mm-hmm. So,
So is one of the hazards of a virtual relationship, if we can call it that, that it represents a narrow band of a wider and messier reality?
Yeah, I think so, and I think it deludes a lot of people into thinking, this is it. Oh, my God, this is it. And we cannot neglect that other part of our reality. We can't. And I've seen so many people think that they can, especially in their first one or two relationships online. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I've met enough of the people I write to online and have this wonderful relationship with a guy, communication with this man in Kentucky. And this is the first time he's had this kind of thing, so he wants to meet. And, you know, I know better. I know, this is great. I really like writing to you. I really like our friendship here. And I know better. I know now that we need to keep it right here.
Mm-hmm.
But, not that every one of them has to be kept right there. Some do. Some develop into, you know, many people have met and married or lived together for years. And I would be open to that. But in this particular one, there were a few clues I had learned to look for that made me think, no, this is not one that's going to develop into that kind of relationship, and rather than destroy our friendship, I want to keep it here.
Do you think there are some people who are better at online friendships, online relationships than others? Does it take...
Better meaning how?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. You said there are things I learned to look for. Is this just because you had become a more sophisticated...
Yeah, I think so. Uh-huh. I'd seen enough, not just my own relationships online, but my sister's had, she's on her third relationship online. Mm-hmm. I met a woman I was speaking in Oregon who has had like 7 relationships online and has, you know, followed through the point of meeting each one of them and talking with a lot of people who actually met. It doesn't work any... The odds are no greater mm-hmm. when you meet in person than they are without that beginning of a computer. So I learned to see these kinds of things that I would look for in life. I could see them here on the computer now, and I wasn't so just not, I don't know if they were distracted, but I didn't put more emphasis on other things than I would have. I don't know if that makes sense, but just those things that you learn about, you know, you go through a crummy relationship and you learn a few things about what you cannot put up with.
Right.
And so going through a few relationships online and seeing other people go through them, finding those clues that say, well, this is, I know from experience that this is going to turn into that kind of thing. And I don't want to deal with that.
Are there tens and tens of thousands of people?
Hundreds.
Hundreds of thousands of people.
Online?
Yeah.
Oh, probably millions. I don't know. I'm not a good one to ask that. But definitely hundreds of thousands. And anybody who has any kind of computer and a cheap modem can, you know, click into it. Mm-hmm. Here in Fairbanks, I think it's a little more difficult because apparently there aren't a lot of, there's no, not many local access, or maybe no local access numbers, so it's, it becomes a toll call, mm-hmm. and then it becomes, you know, a little more prohibitive.
Which brings me to a question. People say that the that cyberspace is a new... people say that cyberspace is a new springboard for the democracy. It is a... It doesn't...
Everyone has a platform.
Everyone has a place. You don't have to be gorgeous, rich, powerful in the real world, of a certain age, of a certain race,
uh-huh.
abled, physically abled, any of that whole list of things.
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing because when you drop into a room full of 20 people discussing, pick a topic, discussing the latest books, whatever. When we walk into a room of 20 people, we make certain judgment calls. We say, well, gosh, that guy in the big leather jacket and the beard and who pulled up on his big Harley is not somebody that I probably have much in common with. So you kind of, and you have to, we have to. We're confronted, you know, we walk past thousands of people a day and we can't become best friends with everybody. So we have to limit who we find our connections with. So when you walk into a room visually, we make instant visual judgments on people, judgment calls. When you're online, you don't have that visual, those visual clues. So you're right, in that sense, everyone comes down to the same thing. Doesn't matter if you're 12 years old, whether you're purple with green hair, nothing. But I find that we still do make certain judgment calls. Mm-hmm. We just base them on other things. I find, this is really snotty, but I found that I don't talk to men who put their apostrophes in the wrong place. So it's just, you know, oh, God, he's got greasy hair. But still, online, we have to find some way to limit who we connect with. So our connections come in different ways. They're not from the ways that we typically bring them from, you know, race or age or sexual orientation or all those things. We just make them in different ways, you know?
Is there a hierarchy? Is say, are men tend to be more powerful online than women from your perspective?
No,
more in charge?
No, I think it comes down to a completely different thing. It comes down to, one, who can type fastest?
The women have an advantage.
And wit and intelligence. Those are much more important than if you're this stunning, you know, gorgeous woman, walk into a room visually, people are going to have a certain reaction. She can walk into a room online, so what? So what? And it doesn't matter whether it's a male or female. It's just who's quick, who's bright, who has the interesting things to say. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to who's being interesting, because who wants to talk to somebody boring? I mean, if they're gorgeous, if this big stud comes in, women are willing to talk to him just to look at him. But I'm sorry, mm-hmm. if you're typing boring baloney, I don't care how gorgeous you are, I'm not going to talk to you.
So given that perspective, no, I'm not going to ask that question. Never mind. What about the kind of the dark side? Every now and then you hear about a guy who was arrested for harassing a 14-year-old online, or someone who, I don't quite know how this works, but someone is accused of stalking someone else online. What about the dark side of these relationships?
Well, I think humans have, we have a dark side anyway, and no matter what medium we come up with, there's going to be a dark side. There's a dark side of CB radio, there's a dark side of telephone sex, there's a dark side of mail. You know, there is that dark side of humanity, and we can't expect this to be any different. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit safer in that it might be really annoying and irritating and a little bit frightening to have someone sending you harassing mail. There are ways and different services to deal with it, and at least he's not there in your face. He doesn't know where you live. He doesn't know your phone number. But it's still frightening, but I don't think there's any way around any of that. And we can't negate the positive side of this human communication because of that, because it happens in everything. There's a dark side of alcohol. You know, there's a dark side of everything.
Do you do things to look after yourself in that way as a single woman online?
Well, I usually don't go... When I... online, you can typically have several different screen names, and you can choose how much people know about you. So I have a business name that I go under, and it says, you know, the town where I live, no address or phone number, of course. But when I go online just to chat and just to see what's going on, I go under another name that doesn't tell anybody where I am. They can, and then those other, you know, you can always change your screen name. You can complain to... Mm-hmm. You know, the people, the sysops who run it, and as much as you hear the stories about it, it's kind of like airplane crashes. It sounds like a big deal, and I mean, of course, it is a big deal to those people, but for the number of planes that are flying, or for the number of people that are online, it's not that big of a problem.
Uh-huh. Looks bigger from the outside. Looks bigger in the headlines. Robin Williams is our guest today on Conversations. We're talking about space, the new frontier. What's the future of this next universe, this next opportunity in our lives from your perspective? And I know that's a huge question, so I'm looking for whatever comes to your mind.
Yeah,
what's in your
and that's
experience?
Something that I have noticed in myself that I don't have a clue. I don't know where it's going. I don't know what it's going to do. I don't know how it's going to affect us. But I do think that this, with the superhighway coming through, with this potential coming through people's televisions so that it reaches to millions more people than who have computers, I think it's going to be big. I think it's going to be powerful. I think it's going to affect us in ways we don't quite know. And that's why I'm really interested in going in that direction and seeing how is this going to change our lives? Because I'm not really sure yet. There are people who can make predictions about this, but I don't know. I just find it exciting that it's opening us up to more communication. People complain that, oh, well, the superhighway is just going to be 500 channels of more commercials. Well, so what? Mm-hmm. I mean, the library is full of a bunch of stupid books, too. But you can go into the library with 3 million books, and you can find the 20 that are really, you really love. In the same way, so what? There's going to be a lot of garbage coming down this highway. So, you can ignore the garbage. You can find, you know, the treasures in there if you choose. I think it's going to take a lot of education for people to know where are the treasures, how can I get to them. But I'm excited that people will be using their computer or their television for human interaction rather than, you know...
Kind of blitzoid, leave it to Beaver.
I think the potential there is really exciting.
Given that we take our full selves with us to the keyboard, no matter how we might try and obscure, do you think that this is just another opportunity for us to take a look at issues of morality and ethics and intimacy, or is this a new, transforming opportunity for us to take a look at the issues that plague that are both plague and rejoicing for humankind?
I don't know if it's new. I think it's a, what's the word? Not a revolution, but a, it's just kind of a growth. I don't think it's so new that we have to like stop and take stock of, oh my God, how are we evolving here? An evolution, as I say, it's more of an evolution than a revolution. And I think there are a lot of similarities to what we've already been doing for hundreds of years, thousands of years, with some new evolutionary kind of subtle changes that we're going to have to learn how to deal with and how to structure and how to control. But I don't think it's going to be so big that it's this whole new frontier of, oh my God, the psychology of cyberspace. I don't know, maybe.
You never know.
Special psychologist for cyberspace addicts.
I want to spend at least some time before we end our hour taking a look at you and your relationship with the Macintosh. This was not intentional, was it?
No, I was really resistant to computers. I was teaching graphic design and the Mac came out and I said, no, I'm too old for computers. I'm just going to let them pass me by and I'll be 90 by the time the computer can do what I do in graphics. Well, that was really stupid. And I got kind of sucked into it. One of my students brought his Mac Plus over, which was state-of-the-art, brand new Mac Plus, put it on my kitchen table, and it made sense to me. Huh. It just made sense. I can do this. So I kind of switched from doing graphic design into teaching, from teaching graphic design to teaching Macintosh computers. And
did you see it as a new paintbrush, a new way
yes,
of approaching
I
your
field? Yes, I was thrilled that I could now type up the class roster with their phone numbers for my students and not have to retype it every time somebody moved to change their phone number. As a teacher, I was preparing so much class material, and this gave me such an easy way to prepare my class material. And doing graphic design traditionally with layout and paste up and rubber cement and cutting pieces of type and they get stuck on the bottom of your shoe and what a mess, and having to clean up the mess. The fact that I could just turn off my computer and the mess was all cleaned up, okay, that's it. Put this computer on my drafting table.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. It was more this major practical consideration. No more Ruby Lith. Oh, God. So it just kind of grew accidentally.
And teaching?
Then I was, for political reasons, I wanted to stop teaching the graphic design class, and I asked if I could teach Mac classes. So my first class was HyperCard, which I really liked. And then they asked me, well, can you teach spreadsheets and databases? Sure, I can teach that. I ran out and got a book because I didn't know what a spreadsheet or database was. But I'd learned by this time that my skill is in teaching. I knew that if I could figure out how to work the spreadsheet and database, I could teach them how to use it better than an accountant who maybe could use it but couldn't teach it. And I discovered that I love spreadsheets and databases. I just had the best time with them. So it just kind of evolved into, and that's my books grew out of the materials I was giving to my classes.
And they were part of your teaching tools, is that right?
You wrote
the book so you could teach it better?
Yeah, and so they have some reference to take home with them. You can't take notes in a computer class. There's no way on earth I could talk for 2 hours and have them write notes about buttons to push and what these things are. And the books that they asked me to teach from were so full of technical information that my students did not want to know, and they didn't need to know. So I wanted to give them just what they needed to know so that they could have fun with it, mm-hmm. and enjoy what they were doing. And nothing else. If you want to come back and find it, go find it out later. But right now, let's just use this thing.
This is this notion that the tool should not stand in the way of the art or whatever the form is. Tell me about the Mac is not a typewriter. I have to give you this one reason I'm asking this question, if I can. I started typing in 1961. If anyone told my typing teacher that I should not put two spaces after a period or two spaces after a colon, I think he would come back and get me.
Well, he was right, though. He was right. because you were using a typewriter. And on a typewriter, it's true, you do put two spaces after a period. But in any book you take off your shelf, you know, any magazine you read, you have never seen two spaces after a period except on a typewriter. It's because of the monospaced font and the proportionally spaced. And it's so funny to me because that is the biggest problem. There have been arguments. I've seen volumes online debating the one space versus two space. And it just cracks me up. It's like that's the one thing everybody remembers from high school. We don't remember the Russian Revolution. We don't remember how to put a bill through Congress. But gosh darn it, I remember Miss Smith told me to put two spaces after a period. We hang on to that. I know this is the right way. And it's right on a typewriter. And I was, you know, in high school 22 years ago, I was, you know, put through the secretarial track because as a woman, oh, you can be a secretary. And I was a medical secretary in Oakland for years. And then when I came to graphics, so I knew all that secretary stuff. I knew why we were taught, what we were taught to do there. Then when I came to graphic design and was involved in typography, I worked with a lot of typesetters, and I knew what the typesetters did. Mm-hmm. So when the Mac came out, it was very clear to me why people were making these mistakes. And it put me in this really unique position to say, I know why you're doing this, and this is the way it was okay in a typewriter, but now you're not on a typewriter, so let's move on. Let's let go of your old Ford pickup that's three on the column, and let's move to this automatic. It goes forward, has four wheels, it looks the same, but you drive it a little bit differently. And that's all it is. It's just a couple of key things. The Mac is not a typewriter. It's also the PC is not a typewriter. And it's just those couple little things. You don't underline. You don't put two spaces after periods. You use true quotation marks. And it's there are just a few subtle things that turn your work from looking like you don't know what you're doing into a professional-looking piece of paper.
But what this is, more importantly for the reader, is a psychic shift.
Yeah.
Because my keyboard is the same as my typewriter
exactly.
keyboard. It's my IBM
that Ford
Selectric.
Has
it's my
steering
Royal. That's exactly right.
Ford is a steering wheel, four wheels, and it goes forward.
So after the Mac is not a typewriter or the PC is not a typewriter, somebody gets that they're on a computer. It's a different psychic space.
Yeah. You get that this is, there are just some subtle things that are mm-hmm. different. Mm-hmm.
Robin Williams with us today on Conversations. I want to give you these books again in case you haven't found them and then ask Robin what she's working on next. The Little Mac book, now in its third edition. This and all others will be Peach Pit Press out of Berkeley Books. The Mac is Not a Typewriter, PageMaker 4 and PageMaker 5, Tabs and Indents on the Mac, Jargon, an informal guide to computer terminology for both Mac and PC, How to Boss Your Fonts Around, The Non-Designer's Design Book. These last two and PageMaker 5 are all 1994 books. Coming up, I understand, the file format book, graphic file formats. Beyond the Mac is Not a Typewriter, a more sophisticated typography book. And a little Mac book on video and CD-ROM.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And I'm doing the fourth edition of the little Mac book starting next month.
You really got something started here, didn't you?
I guess so. Because it's still, publisher recently asked me to write a book called Beyond the Little Mac Book.
What's in there? What's going
on? Well, I don't know.
Oh, no.
I don't know. I'm going through that now. It would be, okay, now you know how to work your basic machine, but maybe, what about telecommunications? What about, you know, what is a spreadsheet anyway? How do I organize my computer? I'm not sure. It's just I'm collecting a list of things that might be appropriate for that, for particularly for my audience. Yeah.
Have you accustomed yourself to the computer? You're probably one of the few very conscious new people to come to the computer, since you said no, absolutely not, and then were thrilled to find out that it was the perfect paintbrush and then started writing about it. Have you changed in your thinking about this machine since you put it on the drafting board? Has it become a new and different tool in other ways for you?
No, it's become an integral part of my life. And I think it's, I think it, particularly the Macintosh sort of inspires that. And if you talk to any Mac owner, it's, we become bonded to our little Macintoshes. And Mac people tend to be fanatics, you know, this is the tool, this is the machine. And I think what happens with the Mac that doesn't happen with the PC is that it's so pleasant to work on. It's so much fun that in my classes I would see people come in a little bit intimidated and we'd have fun with it and they'd start laughing and they'd be creating things very quickly. And in a week or two, they'd be saying, well, how much does this cost? And and by the end of 6 or 8 weeks, they're creating work for themselves, finding things, looking for things to do to, so that they can work on the machine. Well, maybe I could put the brownie doos on the machine. and I think that's a big difference between the PC and the Mac. The PC you use to get your work done, and the Mac, you invent things to do, to use the machine for.
With the development of the whole... the whole Windows software on the PC, is that a sign of the merging of these two systems? Critique PC and tell me how far behind you think it is from the Mac.
Well, they're getting closer and closer. It cracks me up how, you know, the PC world was laughing at the Mac, that little toy, that silly little machine with its stupid mouse and stupid little Windows. And lo and behold, you know, 10 years later, they're trying to make the PCs act like Macintoshes, which I just find very amusing. and Mac people laugh at Windows. You know, it's considered a kludge. It's slow. It's trying to fake it. It's trying to put this. But it's great, you know, because people, I don't want to bash PCs because they're great machines for some people. I can't make predictions about that, and I don't work with the Windows enough. But if it makes people feel better that they, you know, some people, Windows people think, oh, well, now it's just like a Mac, which is a really ridiculous statement, especially if you work on a Mac and see the differences. But that's okay if they want to make it look like a Mac and make them feel better. That's all right. I'm not too worried about it. But with the Power PC, the Power Macs, the potential's getting closer and closer. And we have to, everything has to go cross-platform sooner just to make the world easier.
And cross-platform to an insider is what?
Means that you can use the same stuff on Mac or PC. You can work on a PC at work, take it home, and work on the same thing in your Macintosh. Mm-hmm. Crossing those two different kinds of platforms. Mm-hmm. And we're getting closer and closer to that.
Are there things that you think are there things that you think the personal computer will be able to do that we can't do at all yet? Are there yet more places to leap from?
I'm constantly amazed. I'm also I have no clue because it's just all a magical mystery to me. And what they keep coming up with is, I mean, I tend to be very satisfied with what it does right now. And then they do something else, and oh my God, how did I ever live without them? And it cracks me up to see my students will come in, and I did the same thing. They'd say, oh, it can do this, it can do that, oh my gosh, oh, look at that. And we're so excited, and it takes a very short time before we say, well, why doesn't it do this? Why doesn't it do that? Why doesn't it make my coffee and do my laundry? We want it to do more and more. But I don't know. I mean, it does incredible things. You know, it regulates the temperatures in winery vats. And it does things. It reminds me of when Edison discovered electricity. I thought, oh, we can make lights. And other people said, and vacuum cleaners and washing machines. Beyond what he ever imagined. So I just kind of bumble along with it and gape in awe at what it comes up with. And I have no clue what it's going to do next.
What are you going to do next?
What am I going to do next? Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think I want to follow this information superhighway in the telecommunications, because I think that technology and the masses need a bridge. How does it affect my mom and her life? You know, big deal, she doesn't get it. I think it's going to be so big and so important that it's going to need someone like me who can take it from technology to most of the people and say, well, this is what they're talking about. This is what they're doing that you can tap into. So I think I want to go in that direction.
Is that a new book?
Not yet.
I mean, is that when it emerges, will it emerge as a book?
Probably. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else I'd make money. I don't know. It's an exciting time. I kind of feel like I've always regretted that I didn't get to come across on the wagon trains. And I miss that, and this feels like my wagon train, and I'm on the train. I'm not leading the train, you know, I'm not trailblazing it, but I'm on the train. And I think it's exciting.
Well, there's a lot of people following behind you on this train, carrying your books, I think. Whether it's the little MacBook or the ones yet to come. Robin Williams has been our guest today on Conversations. Thanks a lot for taking time. The Apple Moose brought Robin to Fairbanks. Yes, that's M-O-U-S-S-E, also known as Alaska's premier Apple Macintosh users group. While she was in Fairbanks, she talked about the electronic highway and people who are traveling on it in their intimate relationships. Today, we've taken a look at that highway ourselves with Robin Williams. Thanks again. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Susan.
We'll look for more books. I'm Susan McKinnis. This has been Conversations. I hope you join me again next week.